schedule, visit kpft.org, or just sit back and listen starting the 14th of August.
Your Knees by Texas native Ray Lynch. It's Wednesday, 8 p.m., friends, and time for So What's Your Story. I'm Warren Holloman. Tonight I'll be your host, and here with me as always is Nicole Rocherlin. Hello, Nicole.
Hello, good evening.
How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. How are you?
I'm great. We're the only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling. And we're right here on listener-sponsored, corporate-free 90.1 FM KPFT Houston. Nicole and I do this show because we believe that every day and of every life is a story worth telling. And we believe that stories have power, power to bring meaning to our lives, to link us to our past, to link us to our culture, to our community, and to all the cultures and all the communities that make up this quilt we call our world. Here on this show, we love all kinds of stories, and it's astounding to find similarities between the personal stories we tell ourselves and the traditional stories. I'm thinking folk tales, fables, fairy tales that are passed down through our cultures and through our communities. After all, every story is made of the same fabric. They all have conflict, they all have a protagonist, a setting, memorable motifs, and of course, a theme. Themes are truly essential because that's the common thread, that's the common idea in a story. And tonight our guest will share a personal narrative and a folk tale with parables that are conspicuously close to each other. Tonight I'm calling the show Full Circle because each of our storytelling guests originally came to this show as storytellers. They were so good they were asked to become host of the show, which is wonderful except for one thing. Hank, Mary, and Greg don't get to tell so many stories anymore. And so tonight, they're going to do a role reversal, and they're going to be my guests on the show. Welcome. How does it feel to be a storyteller tonight, friends?
Well, it feels good, but but I'm in the wrong chair. It's just taking me a little getting used to.
Right. Yeah. It's although interesting being in the corner here.
But. I'm also glad Warren had to do the script.
Yeah. Yes.
It should be fun.
Mary and Greg, I have a quick little question for you. I know you kind of cut your teeth on storytelling at The Moth, and The Moth is a place where people tell personal stories. And tonight I've asked you to do something different. I've asked you to tell a traditional story. What's it like for you to come back to the stories you heard in childhood, but maybe not so much lately?
For me, it's great. The book I'm going to read to you tonight is one that my father read as a little boy, my brother and I read as kids, my brother's kids read, and I read to my girls. And so it's reliving a rich tradition within our family. I love it.
How about you, Greg?
I have to admit that it was outside my comfort zone because I can't think of any time I performed telling a story other than a personal story.
Right.
So at first I was a little unnerved by the prospect, but then when I finally decided on the story, I felt great about it because with all that's going on in the news and in the White House, it just felt like the perfect story to tell tonight.
I agree. I think you picked a good one. Well, Mary, I didn't realize about your father and your other family, but I knew that you were always an avid reader as a child. And when we talk about children's stories, I'm always talking about the standard ones, Green Eggs and Ham, Rumpelstiltskin, and you're always bringing up stories I never heard of. And I think, in my experience at least, that's the case with the one you've chosen tonight.
It is. This is a wonderful book named Peter and Prue, written in 1924, or published by Mary Dickerson Donaghy. It's out of print, I have the copy that has been passed through the family, has beautiful plates with some black and white, some color plates. And in fact, if you look on rare books and out-of-print books, it'll come up as one that has these prints in it. But it's special for other reasons, which will come up.
And just for those listeners who are Googling their telephones right now, it's Peter and Prue, P-R-U-E.
Yes, and I have a cat named after Prue.
Well, so what's your story?
So this story starts with two children, Peter and Prue, who are constantly running away from home. In fact, the police know them because they're always running away. So I will read to you a little bit of the beginning. "Oh, if only they'd only let us alone now," Prue sighed. "You're past eight, and I'm almost. We're old enough to take care of ourselves, and these spring days are the very nicest to run away in. Remember last year when we got way out in the woods beyond the city?" Peter's eyes brightened. "Don't I? We got so far away the policeman didn't even know me. And a man said, 'Better not go in those woods, kids. There's bears in there, might get you.' And we were so interested, we went right in to see the bears, and there weren't any." "Our grown folks don't tell the truth as they ought," sighed Prue. "We missed the bears. But there were grapevine swings and rabbits and bloodroots. Come on, Peter, we can't stay home. You know we have such pokey, horrid, tiresome homes. No one would think we'd stay in them. Let's go on to those lovely woods again. We might find the bears this time." So their conversation goes on as such until they find themselves frozen in place. And as they look up, they see this woman landing on the porch. Such a very queer someone. A woman short and plump and neat with the roundest of red cheeks, the bluest of eyes behind big round spectacles, the roundest of small button noses, and such queer clothes, or rather such queer things hung about her. Under one arm she carried a broom, and under the other a mop, the two seeming somehow to serve her as wings, while from her belt hung a huge bunch of keys, a rolling pin, and a duster, and on her arm was an enormous mending basket. Peter says bravely to her, "You go away. You scare Prue, and you have no right here." "No right here?" asked the little woman in a pleasant but sad sort of voice. "Indeed I have a right here, a greater right than you have yourselves. I shan't stir a step till I've finished with you two children." "Well, who are you? Well, it's about time you knew you've been treating me so badly. I am the Home Fairy." Now, from here, the Home Fairy chastises them for not liking their homes, and she says, "Tell me, did you really and truly mean everything that you said, that you honestly want to go away forever?" Peter and Prue never stopped one minute to think. They just said yes together so loud that it almost seemed as if they shouted it. So she offers them the opportunity to leave. And at the end she says, "Very well, but there's something I want to explain to you before you start. I now have the keys to your homes and to the hearts of your families. They were yours until you answered as you did. Now they are mine. See here," she held up her enormous bunch of keys and pointed to two very shiny new ones that seemed just to have been crowded onto the ring. "I shall keep them for you until you really want them back again. But when you do want them, you will have to find me in order to get them. I shall never come to find you again. You must come to me and ask." And as they carry on this discussion, Peter decides to challenge her. He saw his mother coming up the street, so he runs up to her and threw his arms around her. Peter loved his mother very dearly, and he knew how much she had always loved him. But now she only frowned at him. "What a rude little boy," she said, pushing him away and straightening her coat. "Who are you? We don't want strange children about. You'd better run away." Well, in spite of the fact that they start to cry, the Home Fairy gives them each a rather magical balloon that raises them up in the sky, and they now begin an incredible journey. Chapter by chapter, they meet different fairy tale creatures and different Roman gods. So they go to the moon, they meet the cow who jumped over the moon, they escape from the moon, they go to Mercury, they're actually stolen away by Mercury, who tells them that he's a messenger, the god's messenger. And of course, this being the 1920s, Peter says, "Oh, you're the god of messenger boys? That was very cute. They go to the court of Jupiter. They meet Diana. They have a ride on Pegasus. And the wonderful thing about this is along the way, they're actually introduced to the meaning of the gods. So Ceres, they learn, is the goddess of grain, and that for various reasons, she only comes out 6 months of the year, which are the 6 months of planting time, and the other 6 months of winter. Now, there's another little part I want to read to you, because this is a book with a story within a story. One story is about the children not appreciating home, and the others are the series of stories of their travels. So they get to Mars. And as they get to Mars, they realize that the people on Mars are very, very strange. If Peter and Prue were startled at seeing the people on Mars, the people on Mars were certainly more startled at seeing Peter and Prue. There were six of the creatures, and they were all lined up in a row and stared. They were tall things. They had long legs that somehow looked sort of waxy, wavy, and large, round, plump bodies from which grew long, thin arms and long, thin necks, which supported heads that seemed to be almost all forehead. "Say something to them," Prue urged Peter. "No one's heard us yet, you know." And so remembering this fact, Peter was able to step forward boldly and say, "I beg your pardon, but we are two Earth children. I am Herringforth van Valkenburg-Piper, and this is Miss Prudence Dean, my friend and neighbor. People generally call us Peter and Prue, and we've lost our heart and home keys and are looking for the home fairy to try to get them back because we want to go home very much. Do you think you can help us?" I think he wants to help. It was a long speech for Peter and was made very nicely and politely, but the queer creatures didn't seem to understand it at all. They made high squeaking noise at one another and then strode over and surrounded the children, peering down at them through those strange glasses, touching their clothes, their hair, with the greatest of curiosity. The group walked together out of the fields and entering what seemed to be a city, for there were many streets shaded by the tall bluish trees taller than trees on Earth. They met other people, too, and saw to their astonishment that the tall, bald persons they had met at first, who had appeared to them to be old men, were evidently children. Everyone set up a clamor at the sight of Peter and Prue, and by the time they got to a sort of park in the center of town, they felt like the animals in a circus parade. Well, that was on Mars. Eventually, they run into Mars the god, who is very distressed. He's been courting Venus, and she no longer wants wars. And they finally get dropped into their home with the home fairy and are able to convince her that they want their keys back, and they get home to their beloved families.
Ooh. Wow. So, Mary, in a word or phrase, what's the theme of that story? For you?
Home.
Home. Home. Good. Good. Well, I understand you've got a follow-up story.
Yes.
That's a little more personal in nature.
Are you ready?
Yeah.
Okay. When I was 10, I had lived in Rio Grande City, which is in the third poorest county in the USA, for half of my life, and I spent my whole day in a blue funk over it. I was so bored, and my mother would try to say to me, "Smart people don't get bored." And I thought, please, don't use that line on me again. And then when I was about 12 or 13, I began haranguing her and saying, "Just send me to a boarding school. Send me to a boarding school. Just send me away." And finally, kind of like Peter's mom, she turns around and says, "If I would, I could. I just can't afford it." And so I, in high school, took extra classes, went to summer school, took correspondence courses, and I graduated from high school when I was 16 and went 350 miles away to Austin to college. And after 4 years, I was very fortunate to receive a scholarship to go to graduate school in England. I was thrilled. And my parents were like, "Well, we won't see you for 3 years." You know, these were the days when flights were expensive. There was no email. There was no internet. A letter took a week to get from me to them and back again. But I was thrilled. I was off. I was like Prue. I was ready for the planets. Now, my story within the story, I will tell you, one summer I went traveling on the continent and I went from Italy to Greece, and I decided to take what used to be the Orient Express line to what was then Yugoslavia, now the Balkans. And I said, I'm getting off in Skopje, Macedonia, just to get off in Skopje, Macedonia, and I'll stay there a few days and then get on the train again. Well, I got off. Four or five people got off the train. The alphabet was Cyrillic. I couldn't read a single sign. No one spoke English, French, or Spanish. I suddenly realized that those four or five other people that got off might be my lifeline, and I ran after them. So wait for me, wait for me. We went into the town. Now, much like Peter and Prue in Mars, the people began pouring out into the local plaza. And as we were walking along, and you know you have a little circle with your boundary as you're talking within your group, a young person from Skopje would enter our group, enter into the center, stare at us, look at us, and we would try all the languages we knew, Swedish, English, French, Spanish. We would try hand gestures, nothing. And this person would stare at us for a while and then slip out again. This happened several times. It was a little strange. The other four of them were going on to Dubrovnik, and I quickly decided that I, too, was going on to Dubrovnik with them. Got on the bus. It left at midnight, and it's a 12-hour ride, and I had a whole bench to myself. Every so often, I would suddenly hear the bus trying to make something that sounded like a 10-point turn. Reverse, a little to the left. Reverse, a little to the left. And I would wake up and look out, and there would be this medieval, thousand-year-old stone bridge. And I would look down to the chasm of darkness below. And all I could say was, God, I hope my mother's awake in the United States praying for me. Anyway, I made it to Dubrovnik. I made friends with the other Swedish group. And I went on in my life. That little part was the little story within the story of being in Mars. But now the story, like Peter and Prue, I finished my studies in England. I wasn't going back to Texas. I went to San Francisco for a year. I went to Long Island for a year. I went to Manhattan 2 years, broke my record. I went to New Jersey. I went all across New Jersey. I went to Pennsylvania. I actually stayed in Pennsylvania a couple of years. People told me, because in those days we did have address books, they said, you know, I've used up all my e-pages on you already. I went on, my last name is Edgerton. I went on to Tennessee, Tampa, and then I decided it was time to go to the home ferry and get the keys and come home. And so in 2006, I returned home to Texas to bring my children home, to know their heritage and to know their family. And the home ferry let me in.
If you're just joining us, that was Mary Edgerton. I'm your host, Warren Holloman. This is 90.1 FM KPFT Houston. Mary told a children's story that spoke to her about growing up in South Texas and how that story was proleptic for her in terms of her teenage and adult years. Now I'm going to turn to Greg. If you've ever met Greg, you'll know he's the consummate political animal. He's worked on lots
Thank
of
camp. Thank you, I think.
Thank you. He's worked on lots of political campaigns, but I have to say, Greg, one of the things I admire most about you is your ability to reach across the aisle. So tell us your story.
All right. You know, the story I picked tonight just seems perfect for the times, and also I think Hans Christian Andersen is one of the great writers of all time. His stories appeal to children, but at the same time, as you get older, you realize the layers and layers within his stories. So tonight's story is The Emperor's New Suit. Many, many years ago lived an emperor who thought so much of his new clothes that he spent all his money in order to obtain them. His only ambition was to always be well-dressed. He did not care for his soldiers, and the theater did not amuse him. The only thing, in fact, he thought anything of was to drive out and show a new suit of clothes. He had a coat for every hour of the day. And as one would say of a king, he is in his cabinet. So one could say of him, the emperor is in his dressing room. The great city where he resided was very gay. Every day, many strangers from all parts of the globe arrived. One day, two swindlers came to the city. They made people believe that they were weavers and declared they could manufacture the finest cloth to be imagined. Their colors and patterns, they said, were not only exceptionally beautiful, but the clothes were made of their material, possessed the wonderful quality of being invisible. any man who was unfit for his office or unpardonably stupid. That must be wonderful cloth, thought the emperor. If I were to be dressed in a suit made of this cloth, I should be able to find out which men in my empire were unfit for their places, and I could distinguish the clever from the stupid. I must have this cloth woven for me without delay. And he gave a large sum of money to the swindlers in advance that they should set to work without any loss of time. They set up two looms and pretended to work very hard, but they did nothing whatever on their looms. They asked for the finest silk and the most precious gold cloth. All they got they did away with and worked at the empty looms until late at night. I should very much like to know how they are getting on with the cloth, thought the emperor, but he felt rather uneasy when he remembered that he who was not fit for his office could not see it. Personally, he was of the opinion that he had nothing to fear. Yet he thought it advisable to send somebody else first to see how matters stood. Everybody in town knew what a remarkable quality the stuff possessed, and all were anxious to see how bad or stupid their neighbors were. I shall send my honest old minister to the weavers, thought the emperor. He can judge best how the stuff looks, for he is intelligent and nobody understands his office better than he. The good old minister went into the room where the swindlers sat before the empty looms. Heaven preserve us, he thought, and opened his eyes wide. I cannot see anything at all. But he did not say so. Both swindlers requested him to come near and asked him if he did not admire the exquisite pattern and the beautiful colors, pointing to the empty looms. The poor old minister tried his best, but he could see nothing. For there was nothing to be seen. Oh, dear, he thought, can I be so stupid? I should never have thought so, and nobody must know it. Is it possible that I am not fit for my office? No, I cannot say that I was unable to see the cloth. Now, have you got nothing to say? Asked one of the swindlers. Oh, it is very pretty, exceedingly beautiful. What a beautiful pattern, what brilliant colors. I shall tell the emperor that I like the cloth very much. We are pleased to hear that, said one of the two weavers, and described to him the colors and explained the curious pattern. The old minister listened attentively so he could tell the emperor what they had said. Now the swindlers asked for more money, more silk and gold cloth, which they were required for the weaving. They kept everything for themselves, and not a thread came anywhere near the loom, but they continued. Soon afterwards, the emperor sent another honest courtier to the weavers to see how they were getting on. Like the old minister, he looked and looked, but could see nothing because there was nothing to be seen. Is it not a beautiful piece of cloth? Asked one of the swindlers. I am not stupid, said the man. It is therefore my good appointment for which I am not fit. It is very strange, and I must not let anyone know it. So he praised the cloth. It is very excellent, he said to the emperor. Everybody in the whole town talked about the precious cloth. Finally, the emperor wanted to see it for himself. With a number of courtiers, including the two who had already been there, he went up to the two clever swindlers, who now worked as hard as they could, but without using any thread. Is it not magnificent? Said the two statesmen who had been there before. Your Majesty must admire the colors and the pattern. What is this? Thought the emperor. I do not see anything at all. That is terrible. Am I stupid? Am I unfit to be emperor? That would indeed be the most dreadful thing that could happen to me. Really, he said, turning to the weavers, your cloth has our most gracious approval. And nodding contentedly, he looked over at the empty loom. All his attendants who were with him looked and looked, and although they could see nothing more than he could, they said, it is very beautiful. And they all advised him to wear the magnificent clothes at the great procession which was about to take place. The whole night previous to the day on which the procession was to take place, the swindlers pretended to work and burned more than 16 candles. The emperor's new suit is ready now. The emperor and all of his barons came to the hall. The swindlers held their arms up as if they held something in their hands and said, these are the trousers, this is the coat, and here is the cloak. They are all as light as a cobweb, and one must feel as if one has nothing upon the body, but that is just the beauty of them. Does it please your majesty now to graciously undress, said the swindlers, that we may assist your majesty in putting on the new suit? The emperor undressed, and the swindlers pretended to put the new suit upon him. one piece after another, and the emperor looked at himself in the glass from every side. "How well they look! How beautiful they are!" said all. The master of ceremonies announced that the bearers of the canopy, which was about to be carried in the procession, were ready. "I am ready," said the emperor. "Does not my suit fit marvelously?" The chamberlains, who were to carry the train, stretched their hands to the ground as if they lifted up a train and pretended to hold something in their hands. They did not like people to know that they could see nothing. The emperor marched in the procession under the beautiful canopy, and all who saw him in the street and all out the windows exclaimed, "Indeed, the emperor's new suit is incomparable. What a long train he has! How well it fits him!" No one wished to let others know he saw nothing, for then he would have been unfit for his office or too stupid. Never has an emperor's clothes been more admired. "But he has nothing on at all," said a little child at last. "Good heavens! Listen to the voice of an innocent child," said the father, and one whispered to the other what the child had said. "But he has nothing on at all," cried at least the whole people. That made a deep impression upon the emperor, for it seemed to him that they were right. But he thought to himself, "Now I must bear up to the end," and the chamberlains walked with still greater dignity as they carried the train, which did not exist.
Greg, what would you like our listeners to take from that story?
Well, we try and stay out of politics on this show, but I think, particularly for me, it's almost impossible right now. I think the entire nation is realizing that our emperor has no clothes, no values, and no substance. And I think Republicans and Democrats are recognizing that. And when I read this story, it just spoke to me as a story of our times.
Yeah, yeah. It just occurred to me, that's a children's story, right?
As I said, it is a children's story, but I think also adults understand maybe layers that children miss.
That may be one children's story they could never make a movie of.
That is true. That is true. That is very true. Nickelodeon After Dark.
So your next story, your personal story, I have titled Meeting the Emperor of Texas. That's probably not fair, but...
As some of our listeners know, I have, from a very, very, very young age, I was not only obsessed with politics, but I enjoyed getting to know and meeting politicians. So I think I was around the fifth grade when Governor Bill Clements spoke at his school. It actually wasn't even my school. I skipped school to go here and speak. Okay. And he gave a talk about a water district in Friendswood that he was proposing. And there was a wonderful picture in the newspaper the next day of the governor of Texas and me, I must have been about 11, walking down the hallway, and he had his hand on my shoulder. And to anyone who didn't know me, it looked like we were having a very nice talk. Mm-hmm. To anyone who did know me, they were thinking, "Dear God, what were you saying to the man?" And what I said to him was, "Governor Clements, I'm a Democrat. I would never vote for you, and I don't support you, but I'm impressed with what you had to say today about the water district." And he said, "Well, why don't you support me?" I said, "Well, you say a lot of good things in speeches that sound like you're for everybody, but it seems to me you only care about rich people." Now, to his credit, he did put his hand on my shoulder. He said, "Well, Greg," he goes, "I'm going to work very hard to prove you wrong," which I thought was a gracious thing to say. And let me say, after two non-consecutive terms, he never proved me wrong. I maintain that. And I'd like to tip my hat tonight to the man who defeated him the first time, the late, great Governor Mark White, right, who we lost about a week ago, who I think was a giant in Texas, and he changed education as we know it in Texas and made Texas a far better place for education. And he was always nice to me.
Yeah, we moved up to 47 now, I think. Yeah. But we were down there. Yeah.
Well, we're not graduating kids. We aren't graduating kids from high school that can catch a pass but can't read.
The maternal death rate in Texas is the worst in the country.
We've got ways to go. Don't get me wrong.
And I guess we're beating some third world countries.
We are beating some third world countries,
yeah. Yes. Yeah. So, Greg and Mary, a quick question for the two of you. As you reflect on the traditional story that you told first, and relate that to the personal story told second. How did the traditional story inform your personal story?
You know, one might say I read Peter and Prue and decided that I was going to run away from home and travel around the world, and it was my inspiration, and then I was finally going to come home.
Right.
As I was going back and looking at this book, I realized the parallels to me having to get away and get away from this very, you know, all the things that they were saying I was saying, and then the realization of how much I loved home. And then the other part were the anecdotes along the way. As I was looking through to say, is there something I can say about the story within the story, I came upon the Mars visit, and it so paralleled my own visit to this to Skopje in Yugoslavia, which was then, I wouldn't say a completely closed country, but it was a communist country at the time, and it had been closed for some time to outsiders, and so they weren't accustomed to seeing people. So the idea, there were, you know, two parts. One is how you meet strangers, how you meet strange things, mm-hmm. and then the other is how you want to go home again.
Yeah, yeah. The word strange came up a lot in that story.
You know, actually, because it's the 1920s, they used the word queer a lot.
Queer, yeah.
But I just didn't think it was right to say, what queer people? Because I didn't think the people of Skopje were queer. I just realized I was without any means of communicating with anybody, and it would be very difficult to eat, find a place to sleep, and so on. And I had a little group I was communicating with, and I think I was all of 22 years old. And so I went off to with the group that I was communicating with.
Yeah.
I think for me, you know, I as I said, I've never told a traditional story in public before. And I think particularly in, because of the times in this particular week that we're living in, I realize how universal a brilliant story is, and that it doesn't matter if it was written 100 years ago or 500 years ago. You know, we're dealing with the same things, and, you know, it is often a child that will lead them. It is a child that is not afraid to speak truth to power. And initially, I didn't even connect these stories. It took me a while to think of a personal story that related. But I remember, you know, just like the child in the story, I was not trying to be rude to the governor. I was polite. I was respectful, but I also spoke the truth. And I think something happens to us as we get older where we are conditioned not to speak truth to power. And I think that's a dangerous thing, and it's something we all need to watch out about. We all need to listen to the inner voice of that child within us that knows the truth and speak truth to power whenever possible.
I've often thought that word dissemble, it sort of implies that it's a skill you have to develop over time. It's not natural
right.
to dissemble. I guess sembling is natural.
Kids are honest.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
They really are.
I agree.
So I think our most recent little boy was Kenneth Frazier. Not a little boy, but the CEO of Merck.
Oh, yes.
On the business council.
Yes.
Who alone got up and said, I'm off of this.
Good yeah. point.
Well, we're all sitting here with our clothes on in case anybody's following us on Facebook
yourself,
Live.
Warren.
At least I think we do.
You can see my clothes, I hope.
This is So What's Your Story right here at Pacifica 90.1 KPFT Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, 91.9 in Huntsville, online at www.kpft.org. Nicole?
Yes?
What's your favorite story so far?
You know, I'll say this. Number one, I don't want to choose between the two.
Oh,
do not do that to me. We have to work together. But I will say that I found both equally interesting. For Mary, I have never heard that story before, so it was refreshing to hear something new, even though it was something that she heard in her adolescent age, and me being the age that I am now, I just love a great story, period. So I thought that was very refreshing, and how you intertwined the two with your personal narrative. I really appreciated that. And with Greg, he read one of my favorite the emperors. You know, I used to love that story. I think it was just funny because the clothes were invisible. I just thought it was really funny, more so than like anything else. But I thoroughly enjoyed to hear that again, even at this age, like I said. So kudos to you both.
Yeah, I think about that story all the time myself. So what's up in the wonderful world of storytelling?
Well, as you know, we are Facebook Live right now, guys, on So What's Your Story? And if you are watching, make sure you give us a shout out. We want to know that you're there. So tell us hello, give us any feedback or any questions or comments you may have. Don't forget to like us on your way out as well. We also have our very own YouTube channel, So What's Your Story 90.1. You can find us on Instagram and Twitter, and coming soon, you will also be able to find us on our very own podcast. But we don't want to forget about our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild. And their website is www.houstonstorytellers.org. And they have story swaps that meet the fourth Tuesdays of every month. And so that is next week. And it's located at 1500 Sunset at Temple Emmanuel, right across the street from Rice University. We also don't want to forget about the Moth Grand Story Slam, which is going to happen on Friday, September 8th at Cullen Performance Hall at UH Central Campus. And we are going to be they will be featuring Greg and Hank, who are two wonderful hosts here. Also, Chris and Harwood from last week. And real quick, Greg and Dr. Hank, tell me, are you guys getting nervous?
No. I'm looking forward to it, but I'm not getting I don't get nervous.
You're not getting nervous. What about you, Dr. Hank? Are you getting nervous?
I always get nervous.
So tell me.
If you weren't nervous, you wouldn't care, and Greg's nervous too.
He's
dissembling.
He's pretending not to be nervous. I'm so proud of you for being so manly and saying you're not nervous. But what is it like to be standing up in front of 1,000 people without notes? What is it like, guys? Tell me about it.
I think it's fun. You know, I mean, if you're comfortable with your story and you know where you want the journey that you want to take the audience on, to me, maybe it's a little bit like flying an airplane, which I don't do. But, you know, you stand up there and you see your audience and you're like, all right, we're going to go on a ride together. It's only going to be a 5 or 6 minute ride, but, you know, we're going to have fun together. And that's what it's like. I used to have terrifying stage fright. Not anymore.
And what about you, Dr. Hank? What is it like for you?
Well, you know, I've always believed that stories are taking people on journeys, and I agree with Greg. I think it's really a matter of taking an audience with you for a few minutes. But, you know, I do get nervous with a large, large audience. I really do. You know, I stuttered many years ago, and there are times I think about that, frankly. I think about what it's like to stutter, and I think about the fact that there were days when, in school, whenever I raised my hand, I never really said anything because by the time I'd get it out, it'd be time for summer break. So as you might imagine, I sort of kept a lot of things to myself. So I do get nervous in front of a large audience. I do.
You know what's weird about me is I am not comfortable speaking to a small audience. Like 25 people, I don't like that at all. But a few hundred people, a few thousand, that's fine. You know, I don't know why that is. But I guess, you know, they're more of a mass as opposed to individual eyeballs.
I guess you have a point. It does take a toll, and it kind of depends on personal preference. But while we're talking about being in front of thousands of people, if you guys go to our Facebook page, again, we are live. But also too, I just want to give a quick shout out to myself because I am in the running to be Miss Ashley Stewart. I was the very first place winner here in Houston, Texas.
Yay.
And voting is happening now, so go to our So What's Your Story Facebook page or to Nicole Rochelin. All the information is there, and make sure you guys vote for me every hour on the hour.
Now, vote for it.
Yes, vote for me. Now, back to So What's Your Story. As we all know, we did previously have guest storyteller Courtney Glauday, who is the writer, producer, director of that film Blink. And he did have a premiere on July 29th, but he has another encore presentation this Saturday night at Match Theater on the 19th. You can also find that information on our Facebook page as well. Now, next week on the show, So What's Your Story, we'll be celebrating the new school year with stories about going back to school. With Hank as our host, we have three terrific storytellers. We have Abby Koenig, Paul Topekin, and Eric King. So don't be late, guys, because tardiness will not be tolerated. So make sure you tune in next Wednesday at 8 p.m. only on KPFT 90.1 FM Houston. Right back to you guys.
And speaking of Hank, he's our next storyteller up. Hank, I know many of your stories are about finding ways to serve others.
Yeah, and you know, if Nicole liked mine the best, she wouldn't have a chance to say it. So there, you know, so there.
So Hank, tell us your story.
Well, you know, this is just like Greg was saying. You know, it's the time of the world that sort of prompted the story. It's a mm-hmm. story that I've told on the air before. It's a short folktale. And what I like best about folktales is that, frankly, you can change the names, you can change the location, and maintain the integrity of a tale. And this is a story about, well, I'll just share it first, and I'm sure everybody will understand what it's about. It's not about politics. It's about human morality. Every year, just before the Jewish holiday Rosh Hashanah, which is the Jewish New Year, there was a rabbi in a town called Nemirov, which is a small city in Lithuania. And every eve of Rosh Hashanah, the rabbi would disappear into the woods. Now, the villagers were certain that the rabbi flies up to heaven to speak with God, that there was somehow a magical ladder in the forest. And before the fate of every soul is decided on the following year, the rabbi would visit God and find out something about who would live and who would die. Well, there was one particular skeptic in town. His name was Moshe. And Moshe believed that there were no such things as miracles. So what he did one Rosh Hashanah was to follow the rabbi into the woods to make sure that he could prove that the rabbi certainly didn't fly up some golden ladder to heaven to visit with God. What he realized, what Moshe found in the woods, is great gestures of compassion. What he saw was the rabbi gather wood and gather food and fruit and berries and take it to various citizens who lived in small shacks in the wilderness. People who had no food, people who had no comfort, people who had no warmth. He saw the rabbi do this house after house, shack after shack, and then he followed the rabbi out of the wilderness. Well, the villagers saw Moshe and they said, well, did you see God climb the ladder? Did you see him reach to God? Did you see him go higher? Did you see him climb higher? And Moshe said, oh no, even higher.
Hmm. Hank, what?
Just a beautiful story about compassion. It's about needing to give to others. I've always believed that my own mantra is that generosity of heart, generosity of time are the two most important things that we can give to everyone. And I think that we have forgotten that as a society. I think that just to say in one word, Charlottesville, the notion is that we have forgotten what it's like to give. We have forgotten what it's like to be kind, collectively, of course. And we've also forgotten to remember that to be passive is to be compliant. We have to speak out against injustices. We have to be able to give to people who need us. We have to be able to offer gestures all the time. 85% of Europe stood by and watched as millions were killed. And we forget that government will do whatever the people allow them to do. The Nazis ruled in World War II because people allowed them to. And we cannot allow bad things to happen in our world.
Amen.
Hank, I know we said we would not get political, so I won't. I'd like to get theological a little bit. That may be worse. You've kind of described, this story has described sort of two different concepts of how we experience God. Mm-hmm. One is climbing a ladder. Yeah. The other is compassion.
Right. Absolutely. You know, I think the digging deep and finding compassion is probably the first step in finding any kind of God. Uh-huh. And that sort of leads into my personal story, if I can sort of segue into that. This is, again, a story that I've told, but the time is right. It's a story about my grandfather, and it's actually a story that I told to my son when he was 10 years old, when he saw this wristwatch on me. It was a gold wristwatch. And he said, as a 10-year-old would, "Hey, that's a nice watch." And I said, "I'm glad you like it." He said, "Can I have it one day?" I said, "Yeah, you can have it one day." "How much is it worth?" He said, "More than you'll ever imagine." Mm-hmm. So he smiled a little bit, and I smiled, and I thought to myself, you know, this could be a good time to have the first real conversation with my son. He was 10 years old. So I said, "Are you interested in hearing the story about this watch?" He said, "Sure." So this was the story, and it was exactly the same story that my grandfather told me every year from the time that I was roughly 5 years old until he died in 1979. The story is that he was in Dachau concentration camp for 3.5 years. He was a person who was my hero. And he was my hero because he saw all of these terrible atrocities around him every single day. But he never, and I do mean never, never said a bad word about anyone. My grandmother was different, but he never said a bad word about anyone. The story was is that he had this gold watch in his sock while he was in Dachau. He had his sock, he had his clothing, because he was a young man and he was a laborer. He was able to keep his clothing. So he kept it in a sock so that the Nazis wouldn't find it and take it away. Well, when he was liberated, he eventually found my grandmother. I should say my grandmother found him and my mother. They moved to this country, of course, and things were good. They had lost, my mother lost a brother and a sister, and it was a very trying time. But my grandfather told me stories like this, and he said them in very positive ways. In any event, when he died, and he told me this story about the watch year in and year out, and I mean every year, around my birthday, as a matter of fact. And frankly, I got a little bored because it was the same old story. But I loved him, and I respected him, and I listened to it. When he died in 1979, a very good friend of the family came up to me with a small box, cotton-laced, and in it was that gold watch with a very small piece of scratch paper which read, "I love you," which was typical him because he was a man of very few words. But yet every word meant something. I think about my grandfather so much because here's a man who saw more atrocities than frankly any of us can possibly fathom. And he was a man who never, and I do mean never, said a bad word about anyone. And frankly, I thought it was amazing, so amazing I didn't even believe him until I realized that it was the truth. Both him and the rabbi maintained the notion of human dignity. They realized what it was like to protect human soul. They realized what it was like to be kind. It's so easy to be kind. It doesn't take much energy to be kind, to give, to smile, to care, to say thank you, to say hello, good evening. It doesn't take much to smile and to be kind. And for the life of me, I don't know why we don't do it enough. I think about my grandfather, and I think about the protagonist, the rabbi, in that folktale, and I can't help thinking that they are indeed one of the same.
Wow.
Wow. Okay, so I didn't get a chance to say this, but I don't, well, let me say this first. I do not have him in any classes this semester, so I'm not sucking up, but that was amazing. That was amazing, Dr. Hank. Yours was my favorite.
Mm-hmm. Well, more importantly, it's not a matter of favorite. It's a matter of what kind of an impact did these stories make on you? Because I think that all of these stories really made an impression. They made an impression on me.
I've never thought about it. Hank.
Pardon?
I've got goosebumps.
Well, you know, Hans Christian Andersen, do we have time to talk about him for about 1 minute? You know, Hans Christian Andersen is was an amazing person, as Greg pointed out. What a brilliant writer. But, you know, if you read a lot of biographies about Hans Christian Andersen, He was a source of so much that we need. He used to make up stories improvisationally. For example, the story about the ugly duckling. Mm. The story about the ugly duckling is a story to behold. He was in a park, and he was telling a story, a cluster of stories to a group of school children. And the school bell rang, and he said, everybody better get off to school. But there was a little boy standing in the corner next to a building. He didn't have any hair. He had cancer, and he had surgery. And cancer in those days was really a death sentence. And he nudged the little boy over after all the other little boys went away, and he said, what is your name? And the little boy said, Lars. And he said, Lars, are you not with the other kids because you're afraid of them laughing at you? And, of course, that's what he was afraid of. He looked to his left, Hans Christian Andersen, true story, looked to his left, and there was a small pond of ducks and a swan. Mm-hmm. And he improvisationally told the story of the ugly duckling to this little boy. This little boy was the son of an attorney in Copenhagen. And the father found out about this, and the father said, you're not going to be a cobbler anymore. I want you to tell stories. He was indeed the first person that we can point to who told stories to heal.
That's amazing. Yeah. I did not know that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. That's why I love our program.
That's why I was so glad. You know, Mary's story brought me back to my childhood for other reasons. And, you know, the idea of us looking at traditional stories and integrating them into the personal ones, I think, is a real beautiful gesture tonight. This is a lot of fun. We need to do this again.
Thank you for thinking of this. I would not have thought of it, but I've really gotten a lot out of this show.
Oh, this is great. I have to say, I have also thought about the Emperor with No Clothes a lot. And in fact, I exchange a lot of political statements with people. And there's someone that I just can't bear to call by name or by position, and I refer to as the Naked Emperor. And I'll leave you to figure out who that is.
Yeah.
And Hank, I want to say I have a friend at work whom I refer to as my work wife. I come in, he's the first person I go to, I can't believe, you know, blah, 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 blah. And when I walk in, we shared a secretary, and I say, where is he? She'll tell me, oh, he's across the street, he'll be back. And he walks in, he's like, where is she? Of course, she always says, it's too early. Anyway, he stopped by my office, he's Jewish, and he said, the riots in Charlottesville, do you realize how much anti-Semitism there was in that? Mm-hmm. And I said, well, I heard read about a few statements. Anyway, I put the news on. There was such anti-Semitism that I wanted to curl up inside of myself on my sofa. It was scary. I didn't want it to reach me from the television. It was so scary. So listening to this story, this is true. I am afraid of that. I don't want that. I want to put it away. But the concept of actually bringing coexistence and forgiveness is so important.
Yeah, there's one thing about people who hate. They're not picky. They'll hate a lot of people. You know, they will hate a lot of people. I know that sounds funny, but boy, it's true.
Good point.
They will, you know, the Ku Klux Klan is wonderful at hating a lot of people.
Yeah.
They're good at something, aren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yesterday was the first time I ever heard anyone talk about the good people in the KKK and the neo-Nazis.
Yeah.
I had never heard anyone say that before.
I want to get back to something Hank didn't say. So you did a great job of deflecting Nicole's praise, and Greg talked about goosebumps, and I'd like to come back to that. Where did the goosebumps come from, Greg, Mary? What about that story made it goosebump worthy?
I think one thing a good story does is it takes you far beyond the words to the emotion of what the writer was experiencing, what the teller is experiencing, and then they intermingle and it ties with what you're feeling and thinking. And that is the gift of a great story and a great storyteller.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm glad that worked for you.
I think there is this emotion. Sometimes there's a connection to humans that we try to separate ourselves from, especially when it concerns something sad or something horrible. So it's easy to separate yourself from. I'm not Jewish. I can separate myself from the Holocaust. My husband was Jewish, but He did not have any relatives that he knew who were in concentration camps. So it's easy to – when you meet somebody who starts to tell you that story and you realize how real it is to your good friend next to you, I get goosebumps because emotions that I've tried to protect myself from are there right in front of me, raw, enveloping me, and I get the goosebumps.
I think we spend much of our lives hiding those emotions from ourselves, mm-hmm. and a good story draw those out whether you want it to or not.
Talk for a second about the Gold Watch.
Well, the Gold Watch is it's a Schaffhausen. It was made in Germany, and it is a watch that, again, was given to me when the day my grandfather died. I knew he had it, but I never saw it. He just made reference to it. But it is one of those things that you really can't do a lot. It's an heirloom that allows me to breathe when I look at it. It allows me to reflect. It allows me to contemplate and to realize things that I've never really thought about before. I was raised with my grandparents and my mother, but we were raised together in the same house. And I heard stories all of my life. I always talk about the fact that I learned storytelling because my grandfather was my grandmother was the perfect storyteller because she said everything in story form. You asked her what's for dinner. She told you a story about a little boy who went to the carnival for 20 minutes. He had to sit there until she said, "Don't ask me again."
I think that Gold Watch takes you back into your grandfather's shoes through that prison camp experience. It's an object that carries not only meaning but literally takes you there.
It's also an anecdote for narrow-mindedness and prejudice when I look at it.
It's a symbol of the heart that he managed to maintain
and survival.
The fact that he didn't become bitter, that he was able to hold on to himself and hide and keep that in spite of everything that happened.
What a class act!
And guess what, folks?
No. Say it ain't so.
Already?
Yes. Greg, Mary, Hank, it's been a delight having you on the show tonight.
Thanks
I'm wondering
for
if we
us,
can
Warren.
Get you to come
Thank
back
you.
Sometime.
We know the way.
Like every week. Right.
I always enjoy our shows together, my friends.
I do too.
I'm proud to be a part of this team. So is Floyd.
Reach Out in Darkness is next. That's 60s retro vinyl. If you don't know what vinyl is, I guess you should take a course in the history of music. Make 90.1 a part of every day. And while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Wednesday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? You keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. Until next week, Mary, Greg, Hank, Nicole Rocherlin, and I remind you it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
And orientation for International Friends at Rice, August 29th from 5:15 p.m. to 6:30 p.m. at Rice University's Lovett Hall. International Friends at Rice is a six-month cross-cultural exchange program that pairs new international graduate students at Rice University with area host friends or families. U.S. hosts and international students discover Houston together, share meals, and more. This program is a wonderful opportunity to serve as a city ambassador and make a lasting impact on a student's life. For more information, email oiss@rice.edu.
90.1 KPFT, Houston.
Black history is happening every day. It's time to start thinking of it outside of a day or a week or a month. We hope to inspire you by enlightening you with those people and events that should be learned from and forever remembered.
Today is August 16th. On this day in 1963, the United States Postal Service issued a stamp commemorating the 100th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation. The stamp was designed by George Olden, who was the first African-American to design a United States postage stamp.
Achievements. Achievements.